Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What do Code Monkey think?
Hello and welcome to From Python Import Podcast. I am Chris Miller, one of your hosts, and I am here tonight. We are broadcasting from Buckeye Beer Engine in Lakewood, Ohio. Woo-hoo. Home of many great beers, and I think we're going to try and be here in the future. So the show will get more and more interesting the longer it goes. I'm here tonight with my erstwhile co-hosts. We'll go around the table, starting with Mike.
Hi, I'm Mike Kernan.
Hi, David Stanek.
I am Gary Bernhardt.
I'm Mike Crute.
And I'm Ben Smith.
We'd like to cop to the fact that we haven't done one of these in 6 months, but the truth is we've been recording diligently every week, and unfortunately, you know, people's internet keeps going out. We've had time-space distortion issues. Things just keep getting eaten. So
someone keeps stealing them.
Exactly. So we're back. We're going to be recording regularly. You're going to get at least one podcast a month going forward, hopefully more as we ramp up. What do we call this? We call this an agile...
Yes. Yeah, we'll adjust our velocity as we go.
Right. So, for tonight, we've got a couple of topics we want to attack. I think the first thing that came to mind is we were looking at the lists, and people are talking about Whiskey 2. What is all the talk about Whiskey 2, and why is this important?
People seem angry about Whiskey 2. I mean, Guido had to step in and, like, smack some people around a little bit.
Why?
So tell me, what's going on? Yeah.
Well, okay, so I guess summarizing the list, at least quickly, is there's at least two or three different people working on PEP 444, I think it is, and there seems to be a little bit of a split. Some of it's being developed off of the general PEP, the way PEPs are developed. It looks like it's being kept on GitHub, and then some of it's in PEP land in Python Subversion, and there's just kind of a disagreement about what's going on and who owns it and all that stuff, so... I guess Guido was mainly trying to facilitate communication. But that's where we are right now. It looks like PEP 3.333, the Python 3 port, is supposed to make it, though. I don't know if it got approved or not, but it was supposed to.
Well, that's really just some modifications on the existing 3.333, right?
I mean, right, it's just the port to Python 3 part.
So what is 444?
444 is actually Whiskey 2, the rethink, rewrite, reimagine.
The next generation.
Okay, so question, we know what's
that report of contention. Is it Whiskey 2?
No. That is part of the, yeah.
So, okay, what's making Whiskey 2 different from Whiskey, you know, 1?
You know, overall, I guess I'm not all that familiar with 444. I didn't read it, I've just observed the arguments.
And the only thing I know that's different, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot that's different, but the async feature, so that you can, and I don't even understand if it's async where you're writing like twisted like apps, or it's asynchronous and that the server can spot off, you know, a bunch of different things, and it's more of an IO blocking server.
Well, maybe some of our listeners know a little bit more and can leave some feedback in the comments. Come educate us. Clearly we didn't research this much at all.
Yeah, it looks like most of the stuff that is just kind of cleanups of things that really shouldn't have been there in the first place and just kind of a streamlining of the spec and then all the async stuff that Dave's kind of talking about.
So what's fancy for async?
What's controversial about cleaning up code?
The async stuff is definitely the point of contention here. How should it work? What is it even? And probably is there a need for it?
What is the point?
Yeah. According to this, async is if the property is set to true, the web server supports async invocation. In that case, the application would be allowed to return a callable instead of a tuple with a response.
Mm. That's a horrible idea.
And that's why it's so contentious.
No,
caveat, the exact semantics are not specified by this specification.
What are you reading? Are you reading
I'm reading the PEP.
You gotta get one off of GitHub though, because that one's out of date.
Is it? Well, yeah. So the one on python.org is out of date? Is that what you're saying?
That's part of the issue.
Yeah, that's quality.
It develops outside somewhere else, and it's not part of the process.
Gotcha. It kind of sounds like the PEP returns a callable that you call to get the actual PEP.
How many callables could a PEP return if a PEP could return callables?
Okay.
All right. Okay. Does anyone else have any thoughts on Whiskey 2 before we move on?
Yeah, the thing I want fixed in Whiskey 2, because I just ran into this building a file upload service, is there's no way in Whiskey to support HTTP 100 continue. I mean, you can do it, but you have to be really careful about it, and God help you if you ever get a framework, because it's probably going to like read your input file descriptor and then your host.
Okay, well, okay. The 100 continue, what is that for exactly for some of our newer folks that don't deal with this very often? How would you use the 100?
Well, the idea would be that you, before you post the body of an HTTP request, say you're trying to upload a file, you would submit a expect continue to the web server, and then it could make a decision whether it was going to allow you to upload or not, and then either say continue or don't. So it's kind of useful when we're building a file upload service to be able to make a decision based on what's coming in, whether we actually want them to send us all the bytes or not.
Oh, okay. All right. And there's no way to do this in WSGI.
No, it's actually pointed out as a hole in WSGI. The theoretical way you could solve the problem is to wrap your the file descriptor you get in with something that actually sends the headers as soon as you read it. But the problem is, if anything, like your middleware or something, reads that file descriptor, your host.
Which file descriptor are you talking about?
The file descriptor that represents the entity body of the incoming request.
So that's the, what is it? Something dot input key or something?
I think it's WSGI dot input.
Input.
Yeah.
But that doesn't actually, that only exists in the case of a post or put.
That's where you need 100.
Right.
Yeah.
But what's the use case for that? Like a really large upload?
Yeah, if you're uploading a really large file.
If you're doing it right, you're buffering it anyway. So why do you need
the... No, the point is to reject it before the client sends 50 megabytes of crap to you. Yeah.
Great. That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you.
We approve. Put that in WSGI 2, would you please?
The problem, I think, is that it invalidates so many assumptions made in middleware and things like that it would never really happen.
I mean, because if you want to put the full HTTP pipeline through something like WSGI, it's complicated, right?
Yeah,
HTTP is friggin' complicated, really. And
HTTP 1.1 has so many subtle bits in it.
Sure, Microsoft has a WYSIWYG tool there. Oh, yeah. HTTP, right? I mean,
if the whole web was soaked, this wouldn't be a problem.
Exactly.
It certainly wouldn't be as
dirty. There are people out there having heart attacks, holding their chests, and oh, the horror. So, WSGI 2, any further thoughts?
I like the idea of the async. I actually hope that goes somewhere.
What do you get out of it?
I guess it wouldn't be useful for me in any of my Python applications that I have, but I can kind of, I don't know, I've been dabbling in a lot of asynchronous stuff with Node lately, so I kind of just like the idea.
Curious as to what the use case is, because, you know, for most async stuff now...
Well, if you want to do, like, long-lived polling, comment, right, stuff like that, WSGI kind of goes out the window.
That's true.
Really.
That's true.
Other than that, I don't really have any input.
All right, then.
Well, here's a question. Does incorporating some asynchronous WSGI gizmo with some non-asynchronous WSGI gizmo screw up any benefit you would get from being able to stack and recompose all the WSGI middleware?
I think the problem is they do have that, but there's like three different projects that do that, all in different ways.
I think mixing them is a losing proposition.
Certainly, yeah.
If you want to mix them, you've already made the fatal error, I think.
Well, and the whole idea that the middleware thing, I think, kind of breaks down because now you're returning a callable, which would theoretically skip all the middleware, unless the middleware goes and wraps the callable, and so now you've still again invalidated all the assumptions and all the middleware that exists today.
I think if people want to do that, they should fork WSGI. Oh. It should not be WSGI anymore.
I say fork WSGI. All right.
So that would be like what, bourbon?
Spelled BRBN.
Oh, wait, someone could. It just happened. Someone just opened up a new project on GitHub.
But does Rack do a better job of it? Because nominally, Rack is WSGI, just not.
Rack is, yeah, but Rack's also more deeply tied to an implementation. I looked at it once and I was just like, I don't understand.
Okay. Tied to MRI or tied to
Rack is Ruby's. It's Ruby's WSGI basically.
It's Ruby's WSGI.
Yeah, and it fixes. It doesn't have start response, which is like its claim to goodness.
But start response is admittedly a hack anyhow. They
right.
the WSGI 2 pep kind of rails on the fact that it really wasn't supposed to be there, and WSGI 1 even says it's just a patch, this stupid thing that everybody else was doing.
So what do they do instead?
I believe they just return the stuff from the callable.
So you just get like
headers or whatever. Yeah, I don't. It's been a long time. I don't
that
would
make it a lot easier.
Yeah, it just kind of makes sense, right?
So I mean, I've got to pass in a fake function and
yeah, right.
Grab the arguments and mess with stuff. And
yeah, it's just very indirect, right? It's like almost asynchronous already, except with none of the benefits.
So, moving on. Testing. This is a big, big topic.
It's the only topic.
It's the only topic.
Everybody should do it.
No, guys, it's bullshit.
But what is testing? I mean, there's like six different levels of testing, and
yeah,
it's a complicated topic for sure.
If you can enumerate them, I will buy beer.
I made up the number six.
I bet I could come up with at least six.
Well, but you've got integration testing and unit testing and acceptance testing,
right?
And
you've got design.
And end testing,
right?
Which I guess is kind of acceptance testing.
End testing?
Testing the full stack from the UI all the way down.
Right, system testing.
The database. System testing.
Yeah.
So we've identified probably two with three different names.
No, that's not true. Integration system and acceptance are different.
And then?
That's system.
So what are the differences between them?
Well, unit testing is the testing of one.
Unit testing.
Okay, let's just. Well,
apparently that's a separate one. What about
yes.
the
okay, those three.
And testing?
Integration is testing the integration of units.
Sure.
System is testing the entire system. Right.
Which is effectively
an end-to-end, right? Acceptance testing, many people view it as like top-down execute everything, but that's not what it really means. Acceptance testing is validating the business rules, not necessarily business rules, but validating the things that the business guy cares about, right? This if I claim the system does something, an acceptance test verifies that.
That's where the specking, whatnot.
Right. It's like right. Yeah. It's like an outside inspect, but that doesn't mean it drives the whole app from the outside, right? It just verifies the rule. So,
it's like executable use cases then, if you were to do like waterfall
yeah,
style.
Yeah, yeah, you could say that. Sort of. Like, if the acceptance test might say only an administrator can delete a thread in the discussion, right? You don't need to drive that from the outside. You can test that straight on the model. It's still an acceptance test.
Okay.
So, the concept of acceptance test is orthogonal to the distinction between unit to system level testing. It's orthogonal to the concept of scope.
I've never seen that before. Usually acceptance testing and other frameworks are based on end-to-end testing.
Sometimes.
That's interesting to me, though, because in all my previous experience, acceptance testing was specific to getting someone who hadn't written the code, who was more business-focused, to make sure that the software does what you say.
Basically,
right.
Do the end-to-end test.
Right.
And
right.
So to me, that's different. An end-to-end test, to me, doesn't mean that the person from the business or whoever the sponsor is understands what that end-to-end test is doing. It just means that they see a bunch of green lights and they go. To me, an acceptance test is they've done the input, they look at it, they say it works. And
well, to me, those two are the same, but what Gary's saying is different.
Okay.
You know, because end-to-end testing to me and acceptance testing, from what I've seen, are usually the same thing. It's just a different person looking at the same result. Are you either driving it automatically from the web interface, or you have some guy saying, yes, this is the right business rule because that's what, you know, we expect to happen. But I think you're saying something a little bit different for acceptance testing.
Right. It doesn't have to be outside in. Cucumber was basically built to do this, right? And a lot of people use it to drive a browser. And same thing in Python world with Lettuce and Pi. I don't know how to say that one. Pi-curacy?
Pi-curacy?
Whatever.
It's like accuracy, but
it's like, you're right.
So anyway, there's tools to do this. People sometimes drive browsers, but you don't have to, right? You can reach in and just run the acceptance test directly against models or whatever.
But so the key is that like a business owner or domain expert's writing the test against your system.
Right.
It's not a developer-driven activity.
Right.
Okay.
That's the distinction.
Is it the case with Cucumber, though? I mean, do business people really write?
Yes.
What is
Yes.
What is Cucumber?
It's a flavor. BDD, behavior-driven specification testing framework, I guess. I don't know. There's not a good definition.
I'm just looking for it because there are going to be people out there who don't know.
What's a less technical thing? Like, why?
Yeah,
like, I've always seen cucumber dust. I've never actually used cucumber. But what does it give you?
It's also cucumber. Never mind.
Let's answer.
Gary is a resident expert.
Yeah. I defer to Gary.
Definitely not expert. I mean, I've actually used it, which...
You've touched with the rest of the population.
Okay.
Welcome to expert.
So, yeah.
I think I messed with
the
Claire.
I've tickled it.
I don't want to know that you're tickling your cucumber.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I don't want to know about that.
Too far?
Okay.
All right.
Gary,
bringing the level of conversation back up, cucumber lets you write... sort of high-level tests in English, so you can write in words things like, and this isn't like Ruby DSL words where there's like colons and commas everywhere, this is like actual English, and you say, you know, as a user, when I perform this action, I expect to see this result. That's basically cucumber. And then there's this whole mapping layer where you define a regex that says, you know, when the programmer says, as a user, it actually means whatever. Actually, that's not true. When the programmer says, I should see this, it means, you know, this thing happens. This assertion happens. So that's cucumber. Why was I explaining cucumber?
So, real quick question about that.
Yeah.
Because I've only seen this test, I've never actually seen it work in practice. So the business person writing the English,
mm-hmm.
do they have a spec to write off of that the program is already defined? Or is it the reverse, where
no.
the business user just says what it is, the program kind of has
well,
it?
Well, I mean, you're... The question is wrong because you're asking.
The answer is who? I reject the premise of.
Well done, sir. You're asking the question as if like the business guy is sitting there alone and he's like, okay, I have to write these rules. Really, what you want to do is have him pair with the programmer, and the two of them are basically exploring the outer edges of the problem domain together.
But okay, so if they're sitting side by side, which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yes.
Are they writing the language and the programmer goes and implements it?
They write the English first and then the programmer can make the steps happen later. The programmer basically needs to sit there to make sure the business guy doesn't go off and write something that's like, should be 50 cucumber scenarios and he writes it as one or things like that.
So is this similar to the idea of coming up with stories then? Or is it...
Yeah, this is the story creation process to some extent. I mean, this is how you take the story from a six-word description in Pivotal Tracker and turn it into...
A functional spec.
Something more like a functional spec.
Well, that's kind of interesting then. So by the end, you've almost got a suite that proves that all the features you said you have, you actually have in your software.
Right.
Ah, that's,
I mean, it's not
kind of clever.
If you view it that way too strictly, then you're gonna.
It's cool. Go ahead.
You will be hurt.
Are we driving a Ford Taurus?
No.
No. Okay.
We're
trying
to
find the lights on.
We all drive Hondas and Volvos, right? And we're all programmers.
That's what we're going to do.
I've got the Lambo today.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
That's kind of it. So, in your experience, does that happen at the beginning of the project? Or?
My experience actually doing that is limited. I know people who actually do that on commercial projects with great success.
Is it like at the beginning, and then you write the code and the connection stuff? Or
that seems like a cheesy kind of question. We should get cheesy's Jeff Morgan, works for LeanDog. But no, he's the local. He's one of the few people that's actually done this on a real like business critical project in the area.
Has he really? No.
Yeah,
he goes
he's
around
big
and trains
into it
people.
We should have him on.
Yeah,
we should.
I'm sure he would do it.
Someone look into that.
Next show with cheese.
You can do that. Just come down and drink beer with us and talk.
Would it be weird to go from extra cheese to just cheese, though?
Oh, that's kind of a downgrade.
I was back to testing. So we talked about cucumber, and I don't remember why.
We were talking about cucumber because we were talking about how acceptance tests work.
And tools for
acceptance tests in particular. And that's how we got there. So Cucumber is the Ruby tool.
Right.
Okay. And Lettuce is one of the Python tools?
One of the attempts.
One of many attempts.
Okay.
Because it's Python.
So why does Python suck so bad?
I'm not even being defensive. I actually want to explore that a little bit. Is, you know, you say because it's Python.
Right.
Why?
Because Python doesn't have blocks. That's not the root problem here. This is the other root problem in Python, which is they see something, eight people see Ruby do something or someone else do something, and all eight of them build it in Python. I mean, there are literally, I think I've used three different cucumber clones, and I've seen probably at least two or three more that I never used. And this happens all the time, right? It happened, we had the framework explosion, and there was never there was never the framework contraction that was supposed to happen.
It's actually happening, though, with the Turbo Gears pylons thing.
Yeah, finally.
Now that everyone's figured out a way to do it all with Django.
Right. Everything will become
Turbo
Django.
I don't know. I think Gary's right, though.
Could we be somewhere? Could we be able to play?
Gary's right, though, because now you have Flask and Bottle, which have come out recently,
right.
Which are micro
Those are reactions to... What's the Sinatra?
Yeah,
those are absolutely reactions to Sinatra.
Sinatra.
So a Ruby microframe.
Okay, microframe. All right, cool. So Ruby is driving Python development.
What's
wrong with Python that we can't come up with these ideas on? Why are we copying Ruby?
We're too busy fighting amongst ourselves.
Yeah, we're too busy spending. That's totally accurate though, because if you look at the way, where did WSGI come from? Right. My understanding is Ian Bicking basically said, "Here's WSGI." Mm-hmm. That's my version of it.
But he kind of, my understanding is he kind of culled it together from like, oh, I'm doing this like a dozen times on these projects I'm working
right.
on. Maybe we should name this thing.
EB that did WSGI.
It might have been EB.
Because we were at PyCon in 2005 in DC,
right.
Hanging around at the student center there in one of the lounges talking about web frameworks and web architectures and stuff. And EB was there and was really pushing hard on WSGI. And at that point, it was, I think, still sort of unreleased, unrealized, just sort of a dream kind of.
But still, the history of it, I think, as I still understand it, was just kind of culled together from a bunch of like, hey, I'm repeating myself. Let's
sure.
pull this together and name it, and now we have WSGI.
But it was the reason that the point I wanted to make is that a dude had an idea and then he did it.
Right.
WSGI 2 has been in development for, I think, at least 4 years, right? Because I'm pretty sure it was PyCon 07 where that meeting happened.
You're saying the committee thing busts everything.
Well, not everything.
Is WSGI 2 the HTML5 PyCon?
It's a little Vietnam-y, I think. Because it doesn't justify the amount of effort that's been put into it. And this is a recurring problem in Python, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we spend so much effort and get so little done.
Thank you so much.
Well, but I think the problem is we're trying to design everything by committee. Like, you tend to see this happen when people all of a sudden realize, like, you can build a process around something they do, and then it just goes way out in left field, and there's process around everything, and everything's a committee, and everybody votes on it. And we need to go back to the days where Python was like, hey, I crapped out this idea. You guys cool with it? Okay, let's make it a pet.
Well,
yeah, but then you end up with...
just come up with your own language.
But then
it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. There are too many cooks.
And then you end up with things like our logging implementation. And
our logging implementation.
This could go on for a while. logging's going this way. If you look at what Armin Ronecker is bitching about right now, or recently was, is logging in Python. So what did he do? Of course he went to the standard library and improved the... Oh, no, wait. He wrote his own thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't implement the same interface.
No.
It's totally different.
See,
I mean,
but here's the thing.
Really?
We're a bunch of developers. Or at least I was until recently.
And Mr. Suit Coat.
But, you know, they gave me the lobotomy. But, I mean, who wants to go and fix code when you can write something new?
Yeah.
Look at me. I'm a genius. Look, it's new. It's descended from heaven. It's awesome. And, you know, no one wants to go back and fix the old stuff.
I would rather fix the old stuff because I'm lazy as hell.
Well,
I don't have enough time to screw around and try to figure out a better way to do something when... something that's good enough just needs some incremental help.
Okay, so this
so
doesn't really...
was no other injection framework before Snake Juice?
There actually was not.
There wasn't
really,
no.
Okay. No, I'm asking because I honestly don't know.
The only thing that really existed that, or at least was in somewhat use, was the Python Spring, and they did the exact same thing that Spring did. It was like the kitchen sink.
Exactly. Right.
I just wanted injection for us.
Right.
That's all I wanted.
Okay, I don't just...
But I mean, that's a good point.
Whatever happened with the thing that Zepay was writing?
I think it's really gone nowhere.
Okay.
He's got a kind of
an injection
there
somewhere.
Like
that was the name of it.
No, it had a weird name.
Okay.
I can't remember what it was called, but he kind of did something, but didn't really do anything.
That's another problem.
It's there.
Because
yeah, well, there's like a million implementations of everything when you go look, and you can't figure out what the hell you're supposed to use.
Well, but it really stems from, I think, two problems. One of them is the code legitimately sucks. And I've seen a lot of that crap in Python. The code legitimately is miserable and horrible. And I'm not going to call anybody out on it, but you know who you are. The other one...
I think a talk should be given at PyCon 2011 about bad Python.
The problem is
you're just a bad programmer.
They don't know who they are. They think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's not.
Well, but there's a second problem, and this is the one that the logging suffers from, although not directly related to Armin's problem of slowness. People don't read the code. Python standard library logging, if you don't like the way it's implemented, I respect that, but it's really extensible. You want to do anything, crack open the source files, take a read. You can do just about everything you could imagine you wanted to do, and... it's there. Like, you don't have to write anything new on top of it.
Python's open source? I didn't understand that.
You just have to pay the $500 fee to get a copy.
Oh! Yeah. Okay.
Write Microsoft.
We'll send it to you on $500.
Microsoft Corp. Redmond.
And I can write that out to anybody at this table?
I'll take it.
Yeah, okay.
But no, seriously, we have a logging framework at work that's something like 1,000 lines. And I sat down one day and was like, why the heck is this 1,000 lines? I started reading through and dissecting it and then cross-referencing it with standard library logging. Probably 90% of it overlapped directly on top of what already existed as extension points in standard library logging. So we went and wrote 1,000 lines of code to do what was already there had we written 10 lines. And that's I think a lot of the duplication in Python stems from
laziness.
People don't want to read the damn code.
Well, also a lot of it is that people don't like the approach taken. Right? Web frameworks is a great one, right? The way you do web frameworks and Django versus Turbo is fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like someone did MVC exactly the same thing and decided to rewrite it. Template language is a great one, right? Where some are XML-based, some are not, some are weird tag-based.
But they're all the same thing at the end of the day.
They do the same thing. Well, why do we
know?
I think
you got to worry about being too general there, Mike. I mean, I think, you know, it's easy. Well, it's just another language. Why don't we just do all this in JavaScript? You know, server-side JavaScript. Let's do it all. It's just another, you know.
Okay. I guess, as a point of comparison, I was thinking in my mind when I said that, Django, Jinja, Mako. Which are all the same damn thing.
Well, Jinja, wasn't it a direct port of...
Yeah, that's...
Django done better.
So really there's only two there, and Mako is older.
Wasn't there a recent template
language?
Mako's
just a template language. It's not even an equivalent.
You know, when we make generalizations like that, what we're not considering is the fourth dimension, time. You know, I mean, our logging framework, we're talking about that now, but, you know, when was it written?
After standard library logging.
One of them was before.
One of them was before.
One of them was, I think, actually to backport.
Three of them were before.
No, we have five. Three of them were before, two of them were after.
I don't know the fifth one. They multiply.
There was
about
template languages recently from PyDanny, and it was a...
Oh, that was the stupid template language?
Yeah, stupid template languages. Mako, Jinja versus PHP, Perl, Cold Fusion, various.
But that's more about where you put your logic and kind of application structure.
Yeah, that's what.
And there is that. I mean, so there is a perfectly legitimate difference between Mako and Jinja. Jinja restricts Python execution in the template. Mako does not.
Theoretically, I guess their macro support kind of pushes it more towards being able to do Mako stuff in Jinja. But yeah. They definitely frown upon just arbitrary Python code.
Right. Just as Django does, being a basically port or rewrite, whatever.
Which overall, I mean, I think it makes sense that you should not put your application logic in your pages. That's kind of stupid.
It's fundamentally wrong.
Well, I mean, as an ex-PHP guy, I can kind of empathize a little bit
with the idea that PHP.
Yeah. Look, I can just do this right here, and
so
even though it's a whole...
So Mike back to the deprogramming camp.
Yeah. I just lost all credit on that. I'm going to edit that out.
Yeah. Now you can.
Somebody's going to refer to it later. I see this.
Remember that time?
But you're saying that you know, there's a lot of projects that are exactly the same, and kind of alluded to, there was no other reason other than just to do it themselves.
One of the problems, yes.
I think a lot of it is, most of the things that I look at where there's three or four different ways, it's literally there's three or four different ways to do it. Everybody either, you know, comes up with their own, or, you know, copies off of Ruby or C++ or Java, one of the other frameworks going on. And then now there's like, you want to do a web legitimately though, if you look at Django, Jiro Gears, and Twisted, I'll just take those three. They're fundamentally different in how you can do the same exact thing at the very end. But the way you do it is completely different.
Yes. And this is what happens when pro programmers write Python.
But you don't think it counts, but it does do what Django does.
Twisted does web and chat, and God knows what Twisted does.
It's more a peer of Python than of Django.
Yeah.
True. Programming Twisted.
But if you really look at it, I mean, so think about Bottle or Flask rather, and Django and Turbo Gears. What's really different? Get rid of the syntactic bullshit. Okay, so I can use a decorator to register my application. I feel really great about that.
I can map the URL to the code.
Yeah, that's
how the
huge.
Code is executed.
That's a huge
difference.
When you're web developing, that's the only thing that matters, right?
Yeah,
I wouldn't go that far.
you can have a lot of the model things like outside of Django and outside of Turbo Gears that just do the logic, and you can use those everywhere. But like when you're taking the URL in, if you're in Django, you're doing it Django's way, and it's just
okay. But does it matter? I mean, so if I'm writing Twitter. Does it matter how I map my URLs? Does anybody care?
Well, as
or do they care
frames.
That they can tweet and retweet?
Well,
I mean,
talk about the developer or the user.
Let's see. Yeah.
Yeah. Either end.
It's
I
two
guess.
Different arguments.
Right. No. Okay. So
yeah.
So from the developer point of view,
I like the way Django does it.
But why do you care? I mean,
why do I? Because I have to write the code.
But what's the big difference between keeping your URL mappings in one file and attaching them as decorators? Really, at the end of the day, what is the big difference that makes one? Why will people argue like Django is the best way versus Flask is the best?
I think I can answer this.
Are you kidding?
And it's stupid. It has nothing to do with logic. It's preference. It's pure gut level preference.
And that's exactly
that's
my
what
point.
Drives everything.
Well, there's something to be said for shut the fuck up and code with what you've got.
We had this argument on a prior podcast. I hate decorators for stupid stuff.
Yeah.
And decorator for a URL to me is stupid.
That's like the stupidest stupid.
I mean, so.
What are the other
things? Django completely abstracts two concepts.
But it's not stupid because it's stupid. It's stupid because it mixes concern.
It's stupid because it's an SRP violation.
Right.
It's stupid. Who cares why it's. I mean, we all agree it's stupid. So that's why I like Django's way. There's a file over here that has all these paths. I can connect the code wherever I want, and it just.
You can connect the same code to multiple things very easily.
Yep.
But someone out there listening to this podcast is saying, Dave, you're an idiot. I like decorators, and decorators are the only way to
and
do
that's
this.
Okay.
We can tell Mike Griffin that's
okay.
But to me, decorators
should not be used. Like, decorators right now in Python are used like code.
Yeah,
they
are
code. Common code around everything. And like in the case of a URL, you don't want it to be on the same path every single time. Why would you want to do that?
Well, now your controller is less reusable. While I share your dislike of decorators in this context, I still say that the differences between web frameworks. Wow, that hurt.
If you have to be quiet, you're insulting web frameworks.
Would you like some more beer, Mike?
Yeah. Yes, please. But no, the differences really aren't major enough that we need to have five different web frameworks.
I agree.
I mean, at the end of the day, can we not just kind of sit down and say, okay, I like decorators, but I accept the way Django works, so I'm going to contribute here?
If you look at the popular ones, there's only, I mean, those usually have the major ways to do it. There's probably a couple Django-type clones, Turbo Gears-type clones. Mm. I don't know what even Flask and Bottle and all that stuff looks like.
That's all works up.
But those aren't really as popular as
or web
the main ones.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so I think everybody's trying to do their own clones and copy and change bits and pieces, but they don't get popularity.
But I guess my big point is that if everybody who wrote a web framework just shut the hell up and worked on Django, Django would be the most badass web framework of any language out there.
Or Django
would be Rails.
It could be a complete turd.
I hate to tell you this, but you know what you get when everybody's working on the same thing is everything goes into that thing.
Yeah, but the problem with those people is they like XML.
You know what? That's the notion of everyone working on something is false, right? Because if you look at the distribution of committed code per developer in any open source project is exponential.
Okay.
Like, if you graph the Linux kernel, you've got, like, 50 people committing most of the code, and then a long tail of, like, 5,000 guys who submitted, like, a little patch to make their network card work or whatever.
Oh, just put on their resume.
Right, yeah. Like, I have code in the Linux kernel.
I have code in the kernel. Look at me.
Microsoft falls out of that bucket. Damn it, I'm deleting that one.
I mean, even, like, Rails is a fairly small team of core developers. I don't know how big it is, but it's not, there's not 100 people who are, like...
Isn't it just DHH? Like, doesn't he just wave his hand over the editor?
Not anymore. Now, Yehuda Katz, if anything, would be that guy now, I think, but... because it merged with Merv. But... So the idea of, like, oh, if everyone worked on Django, it'd be awesome, is not true, because no project ever works that way for whatever reason. It's always an exponential distribution.
Okay. I guess I can
but
accept that.
Is it always that way because you have a set of core committers, or is it always that way because it's just that way?
It's always that way because there are few people who can devote the amount of time it takes to commit, you know, 10 commits every day.
Versus a patch every
If you see that you have that, so say you do have this exponential distribution of committers on every single one of these web frameworks, wouldn't it seem logical to say that if we kind of took all these things and merged them into one, you would just kind of push all of those committers, all your big committers, into the same project?
Well, or you then, have then they would... They would all, like, claw each other's eyes out, right?
Right. Yeah.
The problem is in the...
Newton and Leibniz.
Right. If we put them together, we would have an even better calculus. It doesn't work that way.
My brain hurt.
Okay, so maybe that entire rant was a little bit flawed, but it definitely sounds nice, at least when I say it in my head, that if we get all the smart people who are working on totally different approaches to the exact same thing that are only semantically different.
It's just inevitable.
I think a lot of what happens in Python also is there's a lot of smart, interesting people working in Python, and we all suffer from sort of a shiny thing syndrome.
Yeah.
Like, web frameworks became the interesting problem, and suddenly all kinds of smart people said, "Ooh, I've got an idea," and testing and so forth, and now lettuce and various salad-based alternatives to cucumbers. It seems like, you know, anytime some new interesting thing comes along, you've got at least 10 or 15 or more takes on it, and it just churns and churns but never coalesces back.
Right. The funny thing is that Ruby is the language with that people think of as being the shiny new things language. But Ruby doesn't have this problem. Ruby has Rails, it has RSpec, it has Cucumber. Like, there are no notable competitors to these, really.
There's one and only one obvious way to do it.
So why is that?
Did Ruby just
not
do Python at the Zen?
I think that part of it...
That is a curious point that I hadn't considered that, but you're right. It doesn't seem like Ruby developers, it doesn't seem like the community is any more controlled or centralized.
If anything, it's less centralized,
right.
I think.
It seems to me to be a pretty disparate group. I mean, so is it a flaw in the way Python developers are built?
I've thought about this a lot. I mean, the interaction between Ruby and Python is a large part of my thinking in the last 2 years. And I can't figure out whether... I think part of it might be that in the Ruby world, something showed up and was just so good that it completely won. Like, Rails in 2005 was so much better than anything else that had ever existed. Mm-hmm. It just, like, completely dominated.
I disagree. Django was around then.
Django wasn't.
but in all seriousness, so what does Rails really give you over Django that's so much better than...
Well, it's Ruby-based. I mean, Ruby was...
Take the language out of it, though.
I don't think you can take
Rails
the language out of this.
Yeah,
Rails
you can't.
Made Ruby.
Okay.
Ruby was not
popular. I started learning Ruby.
Outside of a scattered bunch of Perl programmers, I never knew anyone else that dabbled in Ruby. Like,
okay.
I had my Python friends and my Perl friends, and then there were one or two. There was never an intersection.
I approached it, I guess, backwards then, because I heard about Rails as...
Well, you're wearing a suit coat, so...
You just sort of dress up once in a while. Anyway.
But you made the assertion that Rails came along and was so much better than anything before it. What, okay, then what in that statement is anything before it?
every other web framework.
In any other language?
There weren't very many other web frameworks.
Because there was, like, TurboGears, right? And TurboGears back then was very primitive. Like, the routing was just
awful. Catalyst in Perl,
Catalyst.
Yeah, Catalyst.
No, I don't think so.
TurboGears was new.
We went to the sprint.
Yeah, we had been
the first sprint.
Yeah, we had been at PyCon at least once before TurboGears existed.
2006 or 7 was TurboGears, I think.
Wow, maybe I'm like totally messing up my
you
chronology.
You can look at my blog on traceback.org. I can post it that we went to the sprint.
Maybe, okay, I will.
And certainly,
I can't.
Rails had superior marketing.
Pearl had a couple.
The website was glorious.
That's part of it.
The screencast.
Well, the Catalyst, I think, was another one.
37 signals. Yeah.
I mean, they put up some really killer apps.
Yeah.
On Rails. Like I remember people going, ooh, look at this. And look at how, oh, Active Record, how cool. And, you know, all of that. And it just kind of went, everyone went, ooh.
I think ORM is really what, like,
that was a big deal.
That was a big deal.
Because I know I'd written my share of those.
Get
but
a year
Rails,
on.
At the time, had got it more right than anything
right.
else.
And Rails also emerged, when it emerged into popularity, it emerged fully formed.
Yes.
Right? Like, it wasn't like...
Well, it was extracted from Basecamp
or
whatever 37 signals was
doing. But it wasn't like a slow ramp up. It was like Rails came out and that was Rails.
Right.
It was done. And it basically, like,
and then
it's still the same
fundamentally. Everything was in the box. I mean, everything that you needed for the basics.
And I actually misstated, too. Rails was in July 04, whereas Django was in July 05. So I'm off by a year there.
What about TurboGears?
I don't know. Keep talking.
so far, Rails has come.
Yeah. Why were we talking about that, though?
I guess actually, it's been a long and winding road, and I've been tracing it, but this is more interesting than what we started with. So
okay, cool.
What?
Oh, that's the stable release. Yeah, so basically, we're looking at Wikipedia right now to figure these things out. And unlike everybody else, Wikipedia lists the last stable release date, not the initial release.
Is that maybe because of the merge with?
Want to know because
this is still TurboGears.
Are you really looking at TurboGears?
Yeah.
I told you where to look.
Oh, TurboGears was originally created in 05, so it was again after Rails was kind of first.
Yeah.
Kind of paved the way
first.
God damn it.
Because Rails came out and then the folks at KPHP decided they could do it, and you know, Django and TurboGears.
Well, also, I mean, you have to, when you look at it cross language, you have to look at language preferences. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean,
but no one used Rails because they liked Ruby, right? Well, okay, maybe Dave.
Well, the concept of Ruby seems
there well
before Rails.
But I mean, from my perspective, I wouldn't use Rails because I don't like how Ruby works.
You're the exception, Dave, because you already knew how it worked. You already knew how it worked. Most programmers had not seen Ruby before Rails.
Most of us worked in Rails.
Well, no, but if you start looking at it, as a Python programmer starting to look at it, I didn't like how the syntax looked.
Because it has...
As a VB programmer looking at Rails...
I forgot about it. I don't want to... I gotta imagine most Python programmers kind of feel the same way.
Well, yeah.
I'll cop to that. I don't work in Ruby because I don't like the way it looks.
Yeah,
I just like the language.
I have a hard time.
Yeah, when I read samples of it skews me out. I get and I back away.
I think Ruby in general, and this is probably a bad opinion, but I think Ruby is a sloppy language. I think Ruby is like the best of Python and the worst of Perl, mashed all together into.
Actually, I would
Ruby.
Say it's
no.
best of Perl.
Yeah,
and
it's more the opposite.
There was an interesting blog post I read a few years ago, and unfortunately the blog has been annihilated, and I can only find a cached copy of this. There's this amazing rant about how Ruby is borrowing like the ugliest things from all the major languages, and it made a very convincing case. It talked about, oh, there's this ugly bit from C, and here are these horrible things from Perl, and here's one or two warts from Python, here's all this other just horror all glommed together, and it's hit every branch on the tree on the way down. And now it doesn't exist, and I'm really sad. So I can't back that up with any facts at this point. I'm very disappointed.
But I don't know. I guess I haven't ever released a Ruby application, but I've diddled around with it here and there. And the thing that always drives me to another more interesting language is it just strikes me as sloppy. And it's hard to quantify.
So, but you professionally write PHP to this day.
I no.
Oh,
there we go. points is
points
of credibility.
Let me say this about Ruby. So my Ruby experience was Ruby Cohen's, right? Where I'm walking through learning Ruby.
Yeah. That was actually a really good way to learn Ruby.
It was a really good way.
It's a great way to learn what you didn't like.
And, well, I mean,
that's
struck me
point.
Most, and I talked to Jim
Wyrick.
Yeah, about it. Because he gave the actual presentation, and it was just, it felt like there's a lot of things like missing, or I had to know things were happening in order to use
what,
the language effect.
Like method missing?
Well, no, I can't remember, like, and this was like going back a couple of years, but like things like return values being different in different cases, or something.
The magic nil that just shows
yeah,
up.
Just like
the magic nil is awful.
Weird things like that just like turn me off immediately.
So did Ruby
like
returns nil no matter what?
No, well, Python does that too.
Yeah.
By default.
None. Right,
none.
But,
right. No, magic nil is like if you look up in an array for a key that doesn't exist, you get nil.
Instead of like a.
Instead of an exception. Instead of a key
right,
error.
Yeah.
Like,
key
oh
error.
God.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's really
yeah.
bad.
But okay,
really
bad.
There's the sloppiness of the language right there. But if you fetch that key with the fetch method,
right.
you get an exception.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just sloppy programming.
That
I'm
is
sorry.
Yeah.
But
I'll agree
there's,
with that.
There's not, like, okay, that's when you said sloppy programming, immediately the nil thing came to mind. And it's like one of my pet peeves about Ruby, and I talk about it a lot. But I can't think of other places where it's that, really, really that sloppy.
I guess I didn't come today prepared to rip on Ruby, so I could prepare counterexamples.
So where maybe we get Joe Pierini in here.
Oh no, we
or Max.
Good idea.
Yeah, I've talked to
Joe would be a better example.
But then we could have Corey come in and just kind of get everybody chill and be like, it all sucks.
Two languages enter, one language leaves.
Well, we have gone for
run by our
time. A good long time here. There was one other thing I did want to bring up, and it's actually more for Mr. Piernot here than anybody else. I wanted to talk. You put up a post about blog software that you're using. It was something that I haven't been familiar with.
Okay.
I mean, we wanted to highlight a project, so
ooh.
This is kind of where I'm headed with this.
Okay.
So tell us about this blog software.
Okay, so I'm using a thing now called Blogophile. That's a static site generator, essentially. I was kind of looking to get off of the WordPress upgrade cycle from hell where,
woo-hoo!
Oh my god, every week it's a new critical security vulnerability, and if you don't click the automatic upgrade button within 5 minutes, then your site is going to be turned into, like, giant kiddie porn, horrible Russian spam magnet or something. So originally I set out... I was actually thinking about writing my own kind of thing because I hadn't really seen anything that I wanted in the Python space. I know Gary had played with Jekyll a little bit, and some of your comments about the silent failures totally turned me off and scared me. Like,
Django has silent failures.
I did not want something that would not let me know what the hell was going on when it went wrong. Like, I need something to fail clearly, loudly, and fast. So that I can fix it, because my time is valuable and I don't want to spend forever dicking around just trying to figure out what the problem is. So I put it off for a long time, and then in August when I was headed out to Colorado for a couple of weeks, I thought, well, you know, before I start writing this thing in the, you know, my evenings just for fun, let's see what I can find. So one last time out of desperation, Googled for Python Jekyll alternative, and within about 5 minutes found Blogophile and started looking at it and said, this is exactly what I was going to write, hooray! So I'm fairly happy with it. It uses Mako for templating, and it's got various plugins for doing restructured text, markdown, pure HTML, other languages that you can parse and how to crank stuff out, and you can write your own, it's pretty extensible. But I've been giving a few things back to it. It really is ready for a next release. I keep trying to bully Ryan into putting together a release, and he keeps saying, well, soon, 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 so maybe calling him out will help a little bit. I don't know. I was thinking about doing sorry, Ryan.
Ryan is this?
McGuire.
Okay, I don't think I know.
Blanking now, of course.
This is
a year and a half.
Well, if only someone had a Wi-Fi device that we could look this up on.
If only, yeah.
So how does this work? How does Blogophile actually work?
So basically, what you do after you get it installed is you can basically spin up a new site using a simple command line thing, drops like a directory template structure in place, You go in with your favorite text editor to the posts directory and write posts. There's like a little YAML block at the top for metadata. Yeah, goofy, huh?
Wow, it really there's is like influenced by Jekyll, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm all right with YAML.
So there's a little YAML block at the top. It's basically, you know, key, colon, some set of things. So you can define categories and tags and a title, whether something is a draft or not, and so forth. And set the manually set your publication date so you can fine-tune that exactly how you want. And at the end of the terminator for that, then you just have whatever format you want it to be, whether it's HTML or Markdown or restructured text or what have you. Then you run a blog file build command from the command line, and it goes and regenerates all of your site, generates all the static pages, and then it's up to you to push them wherever you want, however you want it. The way I've got things rigged up, and I posted about this recently on my blog, about basically what I do is I've got a remote Git repository on my WebFaction account that has a post receive hook that once it receives things does a local checkout build and then rsyncs it into place there, so I never wipe out my site while it's being built, and it won't do the rsync if it fails to build for some reason.
I always just build and check in the built thing.
Okay.
Seems simpler.
What do you use for yours?
Well, I have two blogs right now. One is Jekyll and one is Webby, which is another Ruby static site generator. Both of which have a tendency to silently fail.
Okay.
Webby silently fails less, so I prefer it right now.
Blog file can muffle its failure a little bit, but only if you don't. But you can enable a verbose. And actually, it's got a couple levels of verbosity, which is nice. So if something's really, really failing, you can ask it why and get pretty good output from it.
The reason I like to generate locally and check in is that if anything ever goes wrong, I'll see it in the diff as I check in the generated version.
Yeah.
That's the big thing for me about static site generation.
I'm going back to it because I'm currently chained to WordPress with my blog, but my blog is so remarkably simple that there's no reason I couldn't do it with static.
Right. Mm-hmm. One thing that's nice about doing the whole post-receive remote build thing is you don't have to even install the software locally. You can just check out your own blog, write stuff, push up.
Yeah, there's something really nice about that.
But the reverse is true, right? I only have to run it locally. My server doesn't even have Ruby installed for all I know.
No,
it's a web faction,
yeah,
too.
So
it probably doesn't actually.
So you could go either way.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of possibilities to try to do it. Morgan Goose, who's a guy down in...
Really awesome guy down in Columbus.
Yeah. I've been chatting with him a little bit. The way he has his setup is he's got Fabric stuff set up to do all kinds of things. So he's got like a Fabric command that automates making a new post that sets up the YAML stuff the way he likes it. He's got publication and deployment all through Fabric.
Side note about Morgan, he forked Fabric and turned it into a multi-processing project, so you can do multiple deploys with Fabric now.
Wow.
Really
might
cool
be a topic
guy.
For our next show, I guess.
Yeah, I think that would be... I think we could wrap that into a DevOps talk. Maybe we could even... oh, man, like, if I was going to make geek love with a dude, he would be it.
Wow.
Yeah. We'll get him up here now.
You can take that out, right?
You can edit that out.
We're definitely earning the explicit tag tonight.
yeah, I think it would be cool to get him up here with Scott for the DevOps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Cool.
So, but yeah, it's not too bad. I'm really enjoying it so far. Mine takes about 40 seconds to build because I've got 8 years of blog posts.
Well, that was...
And that's something I definitely want to try to help optimize, but a lot of the time is spent just literally doing the disk I.O. of having to parse all that and then splat out a ton of stuff.
You must be right.
It generates like 30
blog posts.
Yeah, if you think about it, because it does a permapage for every post that you do, plus it does the chronological page one, page two, page three back through eternity, and it also does all your category pages, so everything that matches a certain category. I've got a lot of categories because my data originates from LiveJournal where they didn't have tags, so everything was a category. So I generate like 40 megs of text every time I run this. So 40 seconds doesn't feel too bad on my laptop.
How was the migration from WordPress to... Was there an export?
You can export the regular old WordPress export.
Right.
Actually, no, you don't do that. You don't do that at all. There's a script that comes with it that you can use to connect to your WordPress database and zerp down your stuff, and it writes it all out as HTML files in your post directory.
Okay, anyway, because this would be worth doing, because I just started.
Or actually just writes it out as HTML files wherever you want it, and then you can put them in your post directory.
Yeah, I just scrapped my old blog and started something.
Yeah, there was a
good time.
Yeah, there was a bug in the export program when I first started playing with it, and I spent like 15, 30 minutes playing with it and fixed it and contributed it back up. So hopefully it's if you get a fresh checkout from Git, hopefully it's got that in there now.
How flexible is the permalink structure? So let's say I'm going from a WordPress blog that I'm using a permalink structure that is, you know, date, day, blah blah blah. Am I going to break?
You may have some finagling to do. Although a lot of that where it writes stuff can be tuned for your specific instance.
Okay.
So I kept the same URL structure as what I had on my WordPress blog, and did a real simple mod rewrite rule, and well, everything works.
Okay.
So
very nice. All right then. That's our project for this episode.
Yeah, it could be.
We're gonna learn more.
It's actually kind of funny because right before you tweeted about that back when you were first, I just finished writing my own version of that.
Nice.
me
no one
wants
to read the code, Mike. No one wants to look at what already exists.
Ooh, shiny things.
I figured that was a nice tie-in back with that. But
yeah, so you can find out more at blogofile.com, blogofile.
Sounds dirty.
Yeah.
And we'll put that in the show notes, too.
Yeah,
sure, once those get
ready.
Well, that's about it, really. The film ends mainly visually.
This job fulfilling in creative way, such a load of crap. Code Monkey thinks someday he...
This podcast has been released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives Works 3.0 Unported License. The theme song for this podcast is Code Monkey by Jonathan Colton. Learn more about him at jonathancolton.com. To learn more about us or to catch up on past shows, please visit us at FromPythonImportPodcast.com. Monkey like you.